The little girl peers over the wall into her neighbour's yard, hoping to see her friend. She sees nothing. Then the man's face appears, smiling, his eyes funny, watery, darting everywhere around her, looking but not seeing. He unlocks the gate and invites her through, locking it behind him. She hears the bolt slide into place and has no idea that this is the moment that will change everything. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 153, The Murder of Sasha Lee Crook. Now it's time for my monthly tip about the latest series to watch on CBS Justice, the home of true crime on TV. And from Monday, the 29th of April at 8 p.m, you can catch the South African premiere of the brand new original series, Secrets of a Murder Detective. Presented by Steve Keogh, the seasoned and decorated crime fighter has spent 12 years as a top-tier detective at London's New Scotland Yard and now provides his own authentic insights into the intricate workings of high-profile investigations. Bringing viewers into the heart of each case, every episode unfolds as a standalone, gripping narrative. I had the great pleasure of chatting with Steve on Zoom from the UK earlier this month, and you can listen to this fascinating bonus content interview at the end of this episode. It's well worth waiting for. Be sure to watch Secrets of a Murder Detective every weeknight on DSTV Channel 170 and Starsat 222. And a huge thank you to CBS Justice for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes, you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Letty D, Kuselwa Gongo, Gaino Clark, and Maluedi Fandamava for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout-out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Today's case involves the murder of a young child. These are difficult cases for many to listen to, so please do keep that in mind. It's also one that I briefly chatted with now-retired Detective Jonathan Morris about when I met up with him for the case I cover in my upcoming book. Morris was not deeply involved in this case, his influence only brief, but vital to the eventual solving of the case. In researching this case, I used multiple sources besides my brief chat with Morris, including the judgments from the Supreme Court appeal on this case and several media articles. So let's get into Episode 153, The Murder of Sasha Lee Crook.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Sasha Lee Crook was born on the 20th of July 1994 to her mother Michelle Haneker and her father Lionel Crook. Michelle describes her daughter as bright and curious, shy at first with new people, but ultimately friendly and polite. The principal at Thornton Primary School, where Sasha Lee was in grade 2 in 2003, said the young girl was a sweet, lovable child who was very spontaneous. Sasha Lee had one older sibling, just a year older than her, and a younger sibling who was 9 months old in 2003. In July 2003, Thornton Primary School prepared their learners for school holidays by reminding them to stay safe and only play near their homes. The children said goodbye to their teachers and one another, looking forward to the 2 weeks of holiday that lay ahead. 8-year-old Sasha Lee spent a good amount of time at her maternal grandparents' home in Ottery. She was there often over weekends and school holidays and was well known by the neighbours. Priscilla and Michael Haneker were always happy to have their granddaughter over, and those July holidays were no different. On Sunday, the 6th of July, the couple and Sasha Lee attended church in the morning and then went back home where Priscilla prepared steak and roast potatoes for lunch. Sasha Lee had been a little put out, Priscilla recalled, because she'd wanted roast chicken and asked her grandmother to make a chicken for dinner. Her grandmother agreed with a smile and told the girl to wash her hands and get ready for lunch. After they ate, everyone got dressed for a party they were due to attend at 3 p.m. that afternoon. Much of the family would be there, and Sasha Lee went and changed into a clean tracksuit, ready for the party. She called out to her grandmother that she was going to play in the garden for a while until they were ready to go. Priscilla acknowledged and told her to stay in the garden. When Sasha Lee went into the garden, she may or may not have seen the family across the road sitting on their patio having tea. Antoinette Jacobs and her three daughters did see Sasha Lee, though. They watched as the young girl played on her own for a bit and then saw her looking over the wall into the neighbor's yard. The family that lived next door, the Isaacs, were multi-generational. The matriarch of the home, Fatima Isaacs, lived there with her son, Muhammad, and his wife and child. Her daughter had also lived with the family for a while, with her 2-year-old daughter, but she'd moved out shortly before the July school holidays started. Sasha Lee didn't know this, though, and it was this little girl that she'd sought out that Sunday as a playmate. The Jacobs family watched from their porch as the girl leaned over the wall, seemingly speaking to someone, and then moved to a small gate that led into the neighbor's yard and entered it, following an adult male the Jacobs assumed to be Muhammad, and closed the gate behind her. They thought absolutely nothing of it, though, because Sasha Lee often played with the neighbor's children. The Jacobs went back to their tea and almost forgot about what they'd just seen, so mundane an act it was. Just after 2 p.m., though, Priscilla Haneker stepped outside of her home into her garden and called out to her granddaughter. When she received no answer, she looked next door at the Isaacs' home, but it seemed locked up, as though no one was there. Priscilla walked out onto the street, calling out for Sasha Lee, and then spotted the Jacobs sitting on their porch. Asking whether they'd seen the girl, they said they had and she'd entered the Isaacs' yard. Priscilla once again turned back to the Isaacs, and this time entered, shouting Sasha Lee's name. While her granddaughter didn't appear, Muhammad Isaacs did. He told Priscilla that Sasha Lee was not there. Later, Isaacs would eventually claim that he had told Priscilla that Sasha Lee had been there momentarily, but that she was no longer there. Priscilla denied that he told her this at this time. Having searched the yards immediately around her own home, Sasha Lee's grandmother began to panic and rushed inside to get her husband. Together, they began searching further down the street, with some neighbours joining in. The Jacobs across the road began to pack up their teacups and prepared to assist in the search. As they did, they witnessed Muhammad Isaacs come out into the yard, dressed in a white T-shirt, and stare down the road at the small group searching for Sasha Lee. He then went inside and came back out with a jacket on and headed down the road in the opposite direction from the searchers. After searching for almost an hour, the Hanekers got into their car and headed out to the family party. They wanted to inform their daughter in person that they could not find Sasha Lee and get all the rest of the family involved in the search. Michelle Haneker recalls seeing her parents arrive without her daughter that day. When she saw the expression on their faces, her legs immediately buckled underneath her. Within minutes, the group of would-be partygoers was mobilized and heading back to the Haneker's house to search for Sasha Lee. The immediate surge of adrenaline kept Michelle going, but as the hours ticked by and Sasha Lee was still not found, shock began to set in, and she eventually had to be briefly hospitalized. There's very little information in the public domain digitally about the search for Sasha Lee, when the police got involved, and the details of their search and investigation. The few pieces I could find detailed a rather intensive search, allegedly with hundreds of police officers. The community of Ottery and surrounds also banded together, but there was no sign of the little girl. Again, without detailed information about this part of the investigation, it's difficult to know exactly which premises were searched and when and who was questioned. The Isaacs were interviewed. Fatima and Muhammad's wife had not been home at the time Sasha Lee disappeared. When Muhammad was questioned, he told police he'd woken up at 11:30 a.m. that morning and gone to a friend's house to smoke dacha. When he returned home, he realized that his mother had gone out and locked him out of the house. He'd heard Sasha Lee calling out from the gate and told her that his niece no longer lived there. He said he'd thought the girl may have followed him into the yard, but he wasn't sure as he'd taken off his shirt and gone to sit in the sun, where he'd fallen asleep. When he woke up a little while later, he claimed that Sasha Lee was gone, and he realized that his mother's new tenant had arrived with some of their belongings, including a fridge. He'd helped the man offload, and they'd left. And that was when Priscilla had come calling to ask if he'd seen Sasha Lee. Later, he'd grown tired of waiting for his wife or mother to return and had gone back to his friend's house. His wife had picked him up there shortly afterward and they'd gone to Muizenberg Flea Market for lunch. Now, it certainly seems that police were highly suspicious of Muhammad very early on, but they didn't seem to have enough evidence to take action, including searching his home, until much later. And I'll explain a bit later on why this may have been incredibly problematic, or may have made no difference at all. Either way, Sasha Lee's family was put through a torturous period of waiting and searching for 9 days, until on the 14th of July, a panicked call came into police from a security company patrolling an area in Musenberg. The piece of land had stood open for many years and was often used as a dumping ground by locals, so security guards occasionally did patrols there to put people off. It didn't really work, but on that day, one of the guards had found something he'd never expected. As he passed a pile of rubble, he spotted something he initially thought was a doll, but upon closer inspection, realized was actually a human child. The child's body was in poor condition, decomposed, and sadly, having been found by the stray dogs that lived in the area. Police soon swarmed in, and from the clothing on the child's body, made an initial determination that this was very likely the body of Sasha Lee Crook. If little to nothing had happened in the last 9 days, almost everything happened in just a few hours after that horrific discovery. Michelle Heinecker and her family were quickly informed that a body had been found and were asked to attend the mortuary to see if they could identify the child. Staff at the mortuary did not want them to have to see the terrible injuries to the child's face and neck caused by the animals in the area, so they carefully covered those parts and exposed only her shoulder and feet, as her parents had reported there was a birthmark and a scar on these areas that they could identify. Soon, the terrible truth was confirmed. 8-year-old Sasha Lee Crook was dead. Forensics teams had been at the scene to collect evidence. A few items found around Sasha Lee's body were bagged. Within a few hours, a search warrant was carried out at the Isaacs' home. During the search, police found a piece of wooden board with a marble-look veneer on it. The forensics teams pointed out that this matched something they'd found on Sasha Lee's body. A small piece of wood had been stuck to the girl's tracksuit. It had exactly the same marble look on it that the wood on the Isaacs property had. The wood was found in a garden shed in the back of the yard. In addition to that, on and around her body, there were bags usually used in the construction trade. The investigators knew that Fatima Isaac's late husband was in the construction industry, and they found very similar bags at the Isaac property too. Part of the search warrant included Muhammad's wife's car, which they seized for forensic testing. They found blood in the boot of the vehicle, but it would be too small a sample to ascertain whether it was indeed Sasha Lee's blood. Shortly after that, police arrested Muhammad Isaacs and took him to Paro Police Station for questioning. During this initial questioning, Muhammad denied killing Sasha Lee. He said that she'd called over the fence to him that day and he told her his niece was no longer living there. He claimed that the girl had followed him inside his yard and he'd fallen asleep in the sun, and when he woke up, she was gone. 2 days later, with Muhammad still not talking, police went back to his home for a second search. For reasons unknown in the first search, the officers had not searched the garage area. And when they did on this occasion, they found a plastic bag with a substance on it that later proved to be blood, a piece of pink material which matched the fabric from Sasha Lee's clothing, and was also later confirmed to have her DNA on it, and a torn piece of white T-shirt material which also had Sasha Lee's DNA on it. Both of these items were found in a disused paint can. Police had never been able to find the white T-shirt Muhammad was seen wearing on the day Sasha Lee had disappeared, and they believed that this was part of it. With all of this evidence, police had more than enough to charge the man with Sasha Lee's murder. Of course, a confession would be preferable, as they were not sure the autopsy would be able to give them a cause of death due to the condition of Sasha Lee's body. They went back to Isaac's with this new evidence, but the man still refused to talk. So, the team thought they'd give their local secret weapon a try. Detective Jonathan Morris knew about Sasha Lee's case and was a little surprised when he received a call from one of the investigating team asking if he could chat with their suspect. After reading the dockets, Morris sat down with the young man. As he often did, Morris took a fatherly approach. Isaac's own father was deceased and the man was just 25 years old and not a seasoned criminal, so the approach soon worked like a charm. Isaac's told Morris that he had killed Sasha Lee on the afternoon she'd gone missing. He said he'd strangled her and then stabbed her in the neck with a fireplace poker. He said he'd kept her body in the small shed in his backyard for 5 days, and then he decided he needed to get rid of her body. He'd initially placed her body in his wife's car's boot, but his wife had told him he couldn't use her car when he asked, so he'd transferred the body to his mother's car. He told Morris that he'd gone to the local mosque to pray before driving to the area where Sasha Lee's body was found and attempting to bury her body in a shallow grave. This confession would not be admissible in court as it needed to be given to a magistrate, but if Isaac's confessed to another member of the public, that person could be called to court to testify about that confession, making that testimony admissible as well as any testimony of an officer who had overheard the confession to the member of the public. As Isaac had said he'd used his mother's car, police needed to do forensic testing on that vehicle, so Morris suggested that perhaps Isaac should chat to his mom to clear things up. The man, who was by now in tears, agreed that this would be a good idea. Three officers other than Morris would later testify about the moments that Fatima Isaacs had come to the police station, and as she embraced her son, he had sobbed and confessed to her that he had killed Sasha Lee. Police were able to find a fireplace poker in the Isaacs' home, but it had no blood on it. The pathologist would also later say that she was unsure that the poker could have caused the type of injury she'd found on Sasha Lee's neck when she did her autopsy. A knitting needle would also be taken from the Isaacs' home, which some believed was a better fit as the murder weapon. There were two more issues that would emerge once the autopsy had been completed. The first was that the forensic pathologist did not believe Sasha Lee had been killed on the day she went missing. At most, the pathologist said, she may have been killed on the 10th, 4 days after she went missing, but the level of decomposition did not match up with her having been dead for 9 full days when she was found. Another hypothesis was that the body may have been stored in a freezer for part of that time, which would have significantly slowed down the decomposition process. There was a freezer on the property big enough to fit Sasha Lee's body, but no evidence could be found that she'd been in there. Even if Sasha Lee's body had been kept in the freezer for some time, though, the pathologist said that her stomach contents also proved that she'd not been killed soon after she walked into the Isaacs property. The girl had eaten steak and potatoes with her grandparents just minutes before she'd walked into the yard and disappeared. The steak, particularly, would have taken some time to digest completely, and when Sasha Lee was found, her stomach was empty. This indicated to the pathologist that she'd been alive for at least 8 to 12 hours after she disappeared. If Isaacs had indeed kept Sasha Lee alive for 4 days after he took her. The pathologist suggested that he may have kept her sedated with alcohol and drugs. There was, however, also severe blunt force trauma to the child's head, and this may have rendered her unconscious for some time as well. Due to the nature of the crime, police were sure that they would also find that Isaacs had raped the child. He denied this, and unfortunately, due to the condition of her body, the pathologist was unable to determine this for sure. There was also the matter of there being no blood on Sasha Lee's clothing. The girl had been stabbed almost directly into her jugular vein, and this would have caused significant blood flow from the wound. Considering there was no blood on her clothes, this meant she'd have to have been undressed at the time she was killed. The pathologist did find that only a remnant of Sasha Lee's hymen remained in her body, but this too was not concrete proof of anything, as the hymen can rupture in many different ways. When Isaacs was charged, it was with both rape and murder, and the state hoped to be able to prove the rape charge on a balance of probability and the circumstantial evidence they had. On the 19th of July, instead of preparing for Sasha Lee's 9th birthday, which would have been the next day, her family and hundreds of other mourners gathered for her funeral. Her school friends, neighbours, teachers, and community members spoke of the sweet child she was and mourned the horrific and unnecessary loss. The trial would eventually only begin in earnest in 2005 after Isaacs had undergone a mental health assessment. He had allegedly also struggled to find a lawyer who'd represent him. He went through several legal aid lawyers before the trial began, with most not giving much reason for their decision to end their association with the man, but some saying they didn't feel their client was being honest with them. Isaacs had applied for bail, but he'd been denied and remained in the awaiting trial section of the prison until his trial began. Despite the confessions he'd given, he pleaded not guilty. He'd never confessed in front of a magistrate, and by the time his trial started, he was denying having killed Sasha Lee at all and had reverted back to his claims that she'd been in his yard but disappeared from there while he was asleep. When his mother was called to the stand to testify about the admissions he'd made to her, she denied that her son had ever said such a thing. The woman had also signed a statement soon after the confession, confirming that her son had confessed to her, but when shown this in court, she said that she was illiterate, so she didn't know what she was signing. The state prosecutor presented several points that strongly suggested the woman was lying about being illiterate, and later another witness would inadvertently prove this by speaking about the woman having written a receipt out for him for a deposit he'd given her. This witness was the tenant who Isaacs had alleged had arrived with his fridge around the time that Sasha Lee disappeared. The man testified that he'd indeed dropped off his fridge at the house on a Sunday, and he believed it was the Sunday of the 6th of July 2003. This witness would be found to be unreliable by the judge, as he seemed to change his evidence when questioned and backtracked after being asked to repeat the statement about Fatima Isaacs writing out a receipt. There was also the additional matter of the Jacobs family, who'd been sitting out on their porch for the entire period in question and had never seen a bucky arrive with a fridge on it. Ultimately, the judge would believe that this witness and Fatima Isaacs were attempting to provide tailored evidence that would fit Muhammad's version. Muhammad's defense attorney proffered that his client had also had a hazy memory of events that day because he'd used dacha, but his previous statements had been detailed and clear, and he'd never complained that he couldn't remember anything because of his use of dacha. In an attempt to counter the evidence found in his garage, the defense claimed that it was suspicious to them that the police had only found this evidence in a second search. The implication was that the police had planted the evidence there. But the state put on record that Muhammad had never denied that the paint can belonged to him, and the dried paint inside the can was also the same color as the paint on their house walls, so it was unlikely such a clever plant could have been made. Another alternative scenario offered by Isaac's defense team was that a drug dealer he owed money to may have snatched Sasha Lee, believing that she was one of Isaac's family members. The man claimed that he owed a lot of money to a drug dealer and he'd received threats from them against himself and his family. He thought perhaps the dealer had mistaken Sasha Lee for his niece. The alternative theory did not really add anything to the case, though, because Isaacs refused to offer a name for the dealer so that he could be called as a witness. In addition to that, just from my perspective, Isaacs claimed that he had only ever smoked dacha and no harder drugs, even in 2003, when it was far less freely available than today, you'd have to smoke a whole lot of dacha on account for a dealer to put out a hit on you. So that definitely does sound like a giant red herring to me. Finally, on the 30th of August 2005, Muhammad Isaacs was found guilty of the murder of Sasha Lee Crook. He was found not guilty of the rape, as the judge did not feel there was sufficient evidence to find him guilty on that charge, but acknowledged that the vast majority of child murders of this nature were sexually motivated crimes, so it was highly likely that this may have been as well. As he was being taken down to the cells, Michelle Haneke, Sasha Lee's mom, walked up to Isaacs and asked him why he had killed her daughter. Isaacs whispered to the woman that he was innocent and did not kill Sasha Lee. Shortly afterwards, Isaacs was sentenced to life in prison for Sasha Lee's murder. The judge determined that the murder was premeditated because it was clear the girl was not killed immediately upon being taken. Whether she had been kept alive for 12 hours or 4 days was still unknown, but either way, her stomach contents proved she had not been killed within an hour of being taken, and that meant that Isaacs had time to change his mind about killing the girl. In sentencing, the judge also found that although the state had ultimately proven its case, it was clear that there had been failures in the police investigation which could have led to justice not being served. In addition to the failure to search the entire premises on the first warrant, this may have also alluded to the fact that there had clearly been a window within which Sasha Lee was alive and could have been saved. We don't know how long this window was, but while people were searching for her, she was still alive on Muhammad Isaac's property. Even the fact that in his initial confession he claimed to have kept her body for 6 days is damning. As I mentioned before, without the exact facts of the initial missing persons investigation, it is difficult to know what transpired, but Isaacs was identified pretty early on as being one of the last people to see Sasha Lee. The property didn't even belong to him, it belonged to his mother. And if the woman had no idea what her son had done, surely she would have quickly agreed to a search of the grounds by police. Even just running a scent dog through the yard would surely have immediately given police a hit that she was there. Although there was the fact that Isaacs had admitted she'd been in his yard, which may have skewed results. I can't even imagine the pain and anguish her family, especially her grandparents, must have gone through finding out that they'd been next door to her all that time and had no idea. In 2010, Muhammad Isaacs did exercise his right to appeal in the Supreme Court of South Africa. His appeal was unsuccessful. In 2017, Michelle Heinecker spoke to a journalist on the 14th anniversary of her daughter's murder. The woman said that each year since her daughter had been taken, the period between the 6th of July and Sasha Lee's birthday on the 20th, was horrific. And she relived each day of the nightmare over and again. She recalled during the 9 days that Sasha Lee was missing, wanting to put herself through the things that her daughter may be experiencing. She wanted to be cold, hungry, in pain, anything that might bring her closer to her child's experience. She still admits that she struggles to get over the fact that her daughter may have been found alive if the police had done more when she was missing. Muhammad Isaacs will become eligible for parole in 2030 after having served 25 years of his sentence. Unless he is willing to admit his crime at that time, it's unlikely he will be released. In addition, what is rather concerning is that he was not found guilty of a sex offence, although it was highly likely that this murder was sexually motivated. He therefore would not have been required to undertake any of the programs for sex offenders, and most importantly, for those who could be living with paedophilia. Considering how difficult paedophilic sex offenders are to rehabilitate, it's quite a terrifying thought that he may be going into a parole hearing in 6 years and not have to undergo any rehabilitation around this. Sasha Lee's murder brings to mind the current missing person case of Jocelyn Smith. So many things seem to have gone wrong in Jocelyn's missing person case and been disrupted by external influences, that I truly hope that a vital window to find another innocent child alive has not also been missed there. I don't really want to think about the possibility that Sasha Lee may have been kept alive for 4 days. Her murder and whatever was done to her in that time before her death is horrific enough. The 12 hours minimum that the pathologist determined she'd had to have lived after eating lunch with her grandparents is already more than any human being should have to endure, let alone an innocent child of 8 years old who could not have understood anything that was happening to her. I don't want to think about the fact that she might have been able to hear her grandparents and neighbours calling out her name, trying to find her, and she was just completely helpless for absolutely no reason. Because there is no reason. There's no way to understand what could go through the mind of an adult man who had a wife, a child of his own, and a mother who clearly loved him very much, for him to just decide that this young child no longer deserved to live. It's incomprehensible. And that incomprehensible behavior has not changed over the more than 2 decades since Sasha Lee's death, because so many more children have lost their lives, and many more have vanished without a trace, leaving their parents to wonder what their fate may have been. In the 2 decades between Sasha Lee and Jocelyn, almost nothing has changed. Children still seem to be expendable to many people in our country. And as much as the stories horrify and capture us today, we soon forget and that story is replaced by another, and another, and another. Sasha Lee Crook, rest gently. And now it's time for my interview with Stephen Keogh. Steve's decorated 30-year career in the Metropolitan Police in the UK started in 1991. He spent most of it as a detective before finishing as a senior investigating officer. He joined New Scotland Yard's elite anti-terrorist branch in 2002, and in 2005, he received a commendation from the then Commissioner, Sir Ian Blair, for the work he carried out on the London 7/7 bombings. In 2009, he joined New Scotland Yard's murder investigation team, where he remained for 12 years, building up a vast knowledge of what it takes to catch killers and bring them to justice. Since his retirement, Steve has written several true crime books, runs courses for crime writers, and now has put his hand to television in CBS's new series, Secrets of a Murder Detective. And he's also a very nice guy. I had an absolutely lovely chat with him. So, without further ado, here's my interview with Steve Keogh. After spending 30 years in the police service, I can only imagine the work was deeply ingrained in your core. What was that period like just after you left the police, and how long did it take you to adjust to civilian life?
So I was a police officer for my whole adult life. I mean, I joined when I was 20, retired when I was 50. But when I joined, it was, so you were joining for 30 years. You knew you were signing up for that. And so psychologically, you're kind of building up to that almost from like day one, you're counting it down. So by the end, I've got to be honest, I was ready to leave. Investigating murders can be really draining because in order to do the job properly, you have to give your all. So it means you sacrifice time of your family, your social life. You're just working really long hours. And I was always of the opinion that if I couldn't give it my all, I wouldn't investigate murder. I would do something else. So by the end, I think I got to the point where I was ready to go. And so when I left, it was quite exciting because I didn't know what was going to happen. I published my book and everything, like the TV series and everything, nothing like that was in my mind at all. I had a completely different idea about what I was going to do. And I kind of just, by accident, have ended up doing some things. And even now, like, I've been retired for two and a bit years. I'm so excited. That sort of has really helped the transition. And I'll be honest, I don't miss policing. I miss some of the camaraderie and being around my friends and whatnot. But the actual work, as I say, I think I gave my all and I was ready to go.
I know the work murder detectives do can be very psychologically taxing. Do you think some of the projects you're involved with now have helped you to work through what you experienced in your career?
It's funny. So I think I'm very typical of how police officers deal with the things they see and they're confronted with, and that is just lock it away. You don't deal with it. You just lock it away. And funny enough, filming Secrets of a Murder Detective, the very first episode is me sitting down with a colleague on one of the murders we investigated, Cyan Blake. And she, you know, two boys were killed. And it was probably one of the worst crimes I've ever had to investigate. But I never talked about it. I never spoke about it with anybody. But I did when I sat down with Richard and we were talking about it. And I was... And the way we were doing it, we were sat talking for about 3 or 4 hours, and it was almost like we were back there, and we were remembering what was happening. And at one point, I got upset, and I don't do that. I don't get upset. And I think that I used to think that locking away and the way I used to cope with things was actually I'm brave, I'm big and brave, I can just go on and do with it. But I actually think the braver thing is actually to confront and deal with what you see and what are you experiencing. So I think that me personally, I'm not very good at coping with talking about my feelings. So when I do, I don't, that's why I ended up in tears, because I don't do it. And like when my dad died, I did a eulogy at the funeral. My sisters were with me talking and they were perfectly fine. But I, because it's the first time I'm speaking about my feelings about my dad, I broke down. So, yeah. So psychologically, that's just the way I used to deal with things. Lock it away. And I think most police officers do. And I'm not sure it's the healthiest way to deal with things.
I'm always surprised by the cases that stand out for individuals who've spent as long as you have in law enforcement. Which one or two cases will always stick in your memory and why?
It's always the children. I always found that the hardest to deal with, murders of children, because it's children at the end of the day, isn't it? And as a parent, and it was always heartbreaking. And in my career, not just in murder detectives, but in the police, I couldn't even put a figure on the amount of dead bodies I saw. But the ones that I can remember, you know, if I close my eyes now and I can remember them, it was always the children. And in a way, in a weird way, I find that comforting, because when you're investigating, and I dealt with terrorism and murder, and you're dealing with those scenes and whatnot, at some point you do sort of, when it all quietens down, you look back and you think, have I lost some part of my humanity because it didn't affect me in a way that people suspected it should? And when they're asking me, are you okay? And I'm saying, yes, I am. And I'm thinking, why am I so okay? And you do sort of worry that maybe you've lost something within you. But when you're dealing with children, you know, actually, no, because that's getting to me. And in a way, I found that comforting, because I'm not some psychopath that has no empathy or feelings. You know what I mean? They're there. Yeah. Just I bury them when it comes to 99% of what I deal with.
Are there any unsolved cases from your career that still bother you?
There is one. And it wasn't unsolved in as much as we did convict someone. But long story short, so basically it was a 16-year-old boy got caught up in a gang. They pressured him into coming with them to buy a gun. And the idea was he was going to go on a train with the gun, but they didn't know they were being followed by police. They got arrested and they were in prison. And they put pressure on him to say the gun was his, even though the evidence clearly wouldn't have fit that. And he refused. And on the day before the trial, they lured him to a car, shot him in the head, and set fire to the car. And I become really close to the family. And it was a really difficult investigation. And we managed to convict the ringleader from the prison who organized it. But the person, there were a number of walked free from court. And that to me was the hardest, because I'd convinced myself that one of those was the killer. And I wanted to give the family that person, the one that had taken the life away from their son. And a little bit after the trial, the dad got on a train, come to where I worked, and he bought me a Christmas present. And I was choking up. It was like, they were just such nice people. And I just wanted to, all right, yeah, we got the person that organised it, but we didn't get the person. And that's the one that will always sit with me, that this young lad was murdered by someone who's still out there running around and probably still involved with gangs. And I think it'll always be that one for me, the one that got away, if you like, and that person that pulled the trigger on their son.
One of the cases you cover in Secrets of a Murder Detective is the Dina Thompson case, known in the British press as the Black Widow. What was your experience of female offenders in your career? Did you find their psychology and crimes to be significantly different from male offenders you dealt with?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, the women murderers make up such a small percentage of the... I put something on LinkedIn recently, actually. It was something... I can't remember what it was off the top of my head. It was something like 9% of murders were committed by women, roughly around that. The ones that I dealt with... They tended to be what women that were suffering with mental health, that it wasn't they were going out planning and premeditated murders. It was that they were suffering in some way with mental health. That's just my small sample that I dealt with. Obviously, on the series, we deal with a number of cases where it's women. And off the top of my head, I can think of three that we dealt with, and they were all for gain. So they were all after money. I think it was all husbands, actually. Yeah, I think it was all husbands. That was coincidence. We weren't going out of our way to frame the series. It was all about women murdering their husbands for money. But each of the cases we feature, it was for that. I just think women are just less violent, aren't they? Women are far less likely to resort to violence than men. And when they do, it tends to be that they're motivated by something else. Is it because they want, they're after that money from the husband, or is it because they're suffering from a serious mental illness? So that tends to be, from my experience, but obviously this is just a small sample of my career.
We definitely see that with female offenders in South Africa too. They're often killing those close to them, often with some kind of financial gain, and very often employing someone else to actually commit the murder. Does that match up with what you've seen?
Yeah, 100%. Dina Thompson's the one that poisoned her husband. So she was the only one that did it herself. And the other ones we feature, it was someone on their behalf who carried out the murder. Yeah. Look, taking someone's life is not easy, is it? And women immediately, generally, I don't want to oversimplify this, but generally women are going to be smaller, possibly not as strong as their partner. And taking somebody's life is not easy. It takes something to do that. So it does make sense if they're going to get somebody to, on their behalf, especially if it's for gain, because it's easy, isn't it? If I'm going to get 100,000, I'll give you 20 and I'll take 80. It's much easier to do that way, isn't it?
In the first case covered on the series, we saw the missing persons portion of that case perhaps not attended to as well as it could have been. I will say that this is also a common issue in South Africa when adults go missing. Of the cases that ended up being transferred to you in the murder unit from the missing persons unit, did you find many of those initial investigations wanting?
The thing is, so many people go missing. I mean, thousands in a year in the UK, across the world. So it's not always easy to differentiate between someone who's simply chosen to take themselves away out of their life for whatever reason, or someone who's been murdered. Definitely with Cyan and the boys, that wasn't handled well, because just simply her physical condition, she would not have been able to take the boys away and look after them on their own. That on its own should have spoke volume. So in general, I would say mostly when they come to us, it's because the missing persons unit are doing their job diligently and start to have concerns. I think the Cyan and the boys was probably not typical for us, in that it wasn't the missing persons unit that brought it. It was the chief police officer in that area who saw it in the newspapers and was like, well, this doesn't look right. And it wasn't. So I think, in my experience, that is quite unusual to not pick up on the flag. But as I say, there are so many people go missing, it's an easy thing to miss if those red flags aren't obvious.
Sean's murder was, of course, rooted in domestic violence and control. Over the decades, how have you seen the police's approach to domestic violence cases changing?
Massively. Right. So just as an example, so when I was in uniform, I joined in 1991. And we would go to calls of domestic violence, a neighbour had called or whatever it is, or one of the partners had called. And unless an allegation was made in front of us from, let's be honest, it's normally a woman. It's not always, but it's normally a woman. If the woman hadn't said to us, yes, he's hit me, he's assaulted me, if she didn't say that, the result would be no offence is alleged and we would walk away. And that there would be no record of that. Now, whenever police attend a call to an incident of domestic, it doesn't have to be violence. It can be an argument. It can be coercive control. It could be anything like that. A report is made. So you're building up a history because it's very difficult. I mean, if you're in an abusive relationship, you quite often, and again, it's not always women, but quite often it's going to be the woman feels like she's really dependent on this man financially, emotionally, the children are involved. It's a huge step for them to say to the police officer, especially in the first one or two incidents, yes, I've been assaulted, knowing that that partner could be taken away and her support has gone. Even though it's an abusive, controlling relationship, it's a really brave step for them to take. So the scenario that we were presenting them with is, you tell us now, right in front of him almost, that he's assaulted you, or we're just going to walk away. I mean, it was a terrible way of dealing with it, domestic incidents. And it's no surprise that the murder rate then was higher than it is now. I mean, it's far from perfect now. I think so in the UK, we've just had introduced laws that make coercive control illegal. Because before, what you had is if there wasn't that assault, there was nothing in between. And abusive and controlling relationships goes far beyond violence, doesn't it? You've got psychological, sexual, financial. There's all sorts of control that's exerted over partner by the abusive partner. And there was almost like this black hole. So we're starting to fill that in. But I think we've still got a long way to go. In the UK, what's the figure now off the top of my head? It's something like 1.5. It works out roughly 1.5 women a week that are victims of murder to their partner or ex-partner. So that's too high. So we've still got a long way to go. We're never going to eradicate it. You will never do that. But I think there's still a long way to go in that early intervention of looking for the signs, looking for the red flags, and putting in measures to so it doesn't get to that stage of murder. My partner works. She's a detective. She was investigating murder, and she's now gone on promotion, and she is in that domestic violence world. I mean, the Metropolitan Police have got a long way to go, I think, because the detectives that are investigating these crimes have so many crimes to investigate that it's almost like there, but for the grace of God, because whenever a domestic murder happens, you always go back and you'll see previous reports and what has happened. And I think I can only go by the Metropolitan Police where my personal knowledge is. But as I say, I think we've got a long way to go before we're at a stage where we can sort of rest on our laurels, if you like.
The second case in the series, of course, is a knife crime. And as far as I know, knives as murder weapons are far more common in the UK than gun murders, which are far more common in South Africa and the United States. In your experience as an officer, do you have an idea why knife crimes are so much more common there? Is it just a matter of availability?
It's availability. So having a gun in the UK, the licensing laws are very, very tightly controlled. I mean, we've got something like 500,000 people have got firearms licenses, but they will tend to be, they won't be handguns. They will be shotguns or rifles, generally for like a sporting purpose, or you've got a farm or something. Most people in the UK, but certainly people that live in cities, don't have access to firearms. You've got the illegal ones, obviously, but then we're an island, and we do have guns coming into the country, but it's harder just to get them in. So guns are available, but knives are much more available. And the majority of people that tend to carry knives aren't. We have a problem in our country with the mindset of a lot of our youths who feel that they need to carry a knife because it will protect them, when in actual fact, it makes them more vulnerable. If you carry a knife, there's much more chance that you yourself is going to get stabbed. Now, I personally, I think it's a problem that isn't being addressed. The politicians here pay lip service to it. Certainly now we've got a general election coming up. They have these sound bites. And so, but most of them are absolute rubbish that are not going to impact the problem. The problem is we need to create an environment where these youths don't feel they need to carry a knife. And we're not addressing that at all. I mean, people will come up with stop and search. We need to stop people and search them more. That's not addressing the issue. That's a sticking plaster that's going to punish a few people, but it's not getting at the root cause of the issue. And I personally feel these decisions in much of the problems in society should be taken away from politicians, because they come in, they're there for a few years, all they're worried about is getting voted in the next election. They're not actually dealing with the issue. And in the UK, if we're going to address this, it needs to be lots and lots of different people coming together from all sorts of different, from social services, from the police, probation, schools, parents, all coming together to address it. And we're so far away from that, it's unreal. I mean, everybody's got their own way of dealing with it. But until we all come together, young kids in our society will just continue dying because of the knives. It will just continue.
Looking at Champion's case again, which involved gangs, I think your gang scene is quite different to ours in South Africa, but I wondered how much you'd experienced that being a problem in the UK in your career, and perhaps how you've seen the gang scene shift and change over time.
Huge in certain areas, certainly in the cities. So you've got different levels, really. You've got the younger ones that are probably 12, 13, 14, up to about sort of 17. And they will be, it's all about their postcode, the area they live in, the colours they wear, the gang, what they call themselves. But essentially what these gangs are, the central to them is crime, and that tends to be drugs. And the drugs trade certainly in London and other major cities, is so profitable that this is what is dragging these kids down in towards sort of crime and violence, etc. When you've got so much money available illegally through drugs, the violence associated with it is huge, because everybody wants a slice of that pie. So these kids, they might start off arguing about the postcode they're in or what colour they're wearing, but eventually it will be that they're dealing in drugs, and then the violence is so that each of them understands, sort of, I want this area to deal my drugs in, or however they're carving up how they sell their drugs. But that's where the violence stems from. I think we'll always have gangs. We had gangs when I was young, but it wasn't as violent, certainly, as it is now. And simply because the drugs weren't available and the huge amount of profits from it. Again, I mean, I think all these societal problems, you always hear people saying, they always want to come up with an answer that's really simple in their mind. There is no simple answer to this. And it's one of those where sometimes you feel like you've probably lost a generation. You have to think ahead and try and think, well, how are we going to solve this so in 10, 20 years we don't have this problem? But people don't think like that. Not the people making the decisions. So we've got gangs. They are a problem, and they're probably going to continue to be a problem for generations, I would think.
The first two cases presented quite different end results in terms of sentences. I'm quite interested in the whole life tariff sentence that Sean and her children's killer got. I know you mentioned it's quite rare. How many offenders you arrested in your career would you estimate got a whole life tariff?
So I investigated murder for 12 years and we had two. One was Simpson Kent for killing Simon and the boys. And another was someone who killed a police officer, shot a police officer. Really rare. I think we've got roughly 70 in the UK. So we have 700 murders a year, and it works out at roughly around two a year are given these whole life tariffs. So you can see it's quite rare. Yeah, life doesn't mean life in the UK. It's better than it was. So what you'll see within the series is I talked to some older detectives who investigated crime sort of in the late 90s, early 2000s. And their sentences that their killers got were much less than we get now. So, for instance, in the UK, if you carry a knife to a murder, you get a minimum of 25 years. If there's an aggravated, so it's a robbery or something, they won't put another 5 years on. So the first ever murderer I convicted were the two of them who were robbing another set of drug dealers. One got stabbed and killed and got 30 years, which is a fairly decent sentence. That's a minimum sentence. But then I dealt with another case where it was a four-year-old boy was stamped to death by his uncle. And the injuries were so severe that when I was explaining them to the pathologist, he didn't believe the circumstances I was describing, because we found him in bed. He said to me, this boy's been hit by a car at 30 miles an hour or thrown from a first floor window. And that, because what happened was, his uncle was looking after him and he wet the bed and he got angry with him and stamped and beat him to that point where the worst injuries the pathologist has ever seen. And he got a minimum of 17 years. And to me, those don't equate. A drug dealer goes into that situation knowing he's going to be dealing with violent individuals, gets stabbed, they get 30 years. Daniel gets stamped to death by his uncle, and that uncle gets minimum 17. So the sentencing in the UK is wrong. It doesn't always reflect. So for instance, the carrying the knife to the scene. So what we'll do, we've got a problem with people using knives, we'll make the sentences tougher. Well, what about the women that have been in a violent relationship and have suffered violence over 10, 15, 20 years and eventually die? and their partner is getting a minimum of 17, 18 years. Too many times the sentence doesn't reflect the suffering of the victim and the circumstances. And again, nothing's going to change. It will just carry on. And I can't change it, but I think that it needs to be looked at. The circumstances around the murder need to be more relevant to the sentence, and it's not at the moment.
One of the books you've written is on the Whitechapel murder series. Why did you decide to choose that case to readdress in book form with modern investigative techniques?
So when I left, I'd done a few things, and I dabbled with YouTube. I've still got a YouTube channel, but I don't put anything on it anymore. And I had a really good community, and a lot of them are American. And I was putting videos up, and they were saying, can you do something about the Jack the Ripper murders? And I've got to be honest, Nicole, I knew very little. I mean, I worked that area, so I knew roughly the area he was in. I knew he killed women who were said to be prostitutes. I didn't even know how many. When I started looking into it, one of the things that really jumped out to me was the lead investigator, Frederick Aberline. And our careers took such a similar path. So he dealt with terrorism. From terrorism, he went to Whitechapel. From Whitechapel, he dealt with murder. And my career took that exact same path. I dealt with terrorism, went to Whitechapel, then went to murder. And it just got my brain thinking, like, well, imagine if I were in his position, what would I do? Would I do anything differently? And it all sort of stemmed from that. So essentially what I do, my first book is on how we investigate murders. So I'm essentially applying the first book to the Whitechapel murders case. And looking at, can I bring a fresh perspective to it? So that's how it came about.
I often look back at some of the older cases, even some just 20 years old. And I think that if we just knew then what we know now, I think the result would be very different. Not even fancy technology or anything like that. Just knowledge about things like coercive control, domestic violence, how the offender's mind works, etc.
100%. And just looking at the Whitechapel murders, there's one case where if I'm looking for red flags of a coercive controlling relationship, one of these murders has got them all there. And the person she was in, so for instance, there was a history of violence. There was evidence of control. He basically was locking her in a room and she didn't have a key. They'd recently separated, which is a huge red flag because that's when women are at most danger. And one of the senior officers at the time said that there's absolute, exact wording was something along the lines of, I can't remember exact wording, but they can find no motive on anyone close to her. And you look at it thinking, wow, I mean, this is, if you're looking for a checklist to tick off, you've got them all there. And they didn't even look at him as a suspect. They didn't arrest him or anything like that. And the circumstances of that crime are so different to the others as well. And you look at it and you think, yeah, so it comes down to knowledge, as you say, a complete lack of understanding of those coercive controlling relationships. And this was Victorian times, and probably those they probably accepted that's what a relationship should be almost. But yeah, there's definitely, we've come a long way, I would say, from there.
And that's is my chat with Steve Keir. Don't forget to catch him in his new series, Secrets of a Murder Detective, on CBS Justice from Monday, the 29th of April at 8 p.m. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Lived Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.